Good afternoon. Let's resume, actually, from this morning, our meeting of the title setting board. This afternoon, for the first agenda item, Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, is again the representative of the Attorney General. And then for the remainder of the agenda items, 92, 95, 90, and 91, the Attorney General's representative will be Jeff Blue, Deputy Attorney General. And then for all of this afternoon's measures, the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services for the title board is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. So let's turn then to the first item on our afternoon agenda. This is 2007-2008, number 86, Colorado Housing Investment Fund. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Dunn, I think you're up. One thing I should mention for the record is we did receive a revised fiscal estimate from the Office of State Planning and Budgeting, which I hope everyone has, and that it's on the table. So that may enter into the discussion at some point. Mr. Dunn, if you'd like to present your motion for rehearing.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jason Dunn with Brownstein, Hyatt, Barber, Schreck on behalf of the petitioners. We object to the setting of the title and to the single subject of the measure on numerous grounds, and I don't know how you guys would like to proceed, but I can walk through kind of everything, and then we can go back, or if you prefer, take it one at a time, however you guys would like to.
We do have the benefit of the brief. We've had that. I don't know whether up to the board. I may be highlighting some of it. Actually, it would serve it for me as a bit of a refresher. Not
okay. I'm happy to.
Not line by line, but is that okay? Okay.
Okay. Well, let me start with the single subject issues. In our view, there's at least six separate subjects in this matter. The first, of course, was raised at the original hearing on this measure, and that Section 5 of the measure includes a new constitutional mandate that the General Assembly enact during the next legislative session, the 2009 session, specific legislation controlling how the state, presumably its political subdivisions, go about calculating inflation. As Ms. Eubanks objected in the first hearing, that requirement has no relation or connection to the rest of the measure and therefore constitutes a separate subject. I'll take in the motion number 2 and number 3, I guess, together. Section 3.2i of the measure allows funding for both foreclosure prevention programs and homelessness programs. And this, I guess, is somewhat subtle, or at least it was a little bit subtle to me. I didn't catch it initially because foreclosure issues and I think homelessness issues tend to have to do with housing, and the measure sort of has to do with housing. But what the measure actually says, if you read it carefully, is that it allows the funds, the transfer tax that are imposed and collected, to be used for foreclosure prevention programs and homelessness programs. It doesn't say that the as a result of spending money on affordable housing stock that the result will be less foreclosure or that's a purpose of the measure or less homelessness and that's a purpose of the measure. It actually says the funding will go to foreclosure programs and homelessness programs. And those are each actually in some ways, I think, conflicting with the purpose, the stated purpose of the measure, which is to increase affordable housing stock. And the more you reduce foreclosure, the more you reduce homelessness, I suppose you've, in some part, reduced the amount of affordable housing. That's assuming that people that are in the foreclosure process are in affordable housing, whatever that might be. But as we all know too well right now, very expensive homes can go through the foreclosure process and have nothing to do with affordable housing. So we think those measures are both issues that have nothing to do with the stated purpose of the measure. And I think, this is, you know, my personal opinion, you guys know the case law and the discussion about provisions hidden within the folds of a measure in order to create political coalitions to help pass a measure down the road. And I think when you involve these kind of measures and they're not included in the purpose of the measure and they're not included in the title of the measure, I think we fall right within the umbrella of that language, what the Supreme Court says it's your duty to prevent against. Fourth, the measure allows for the imposition of the transfer tax to fund social programs that are commonly associated with, quote-unquote, permanent supportive housing, and that's a term that's used in the definitional section in Section 2.2, the definition of affordable housing stock. And I actually had to look that term up on the internet to figure out what that meant. And what, you know, I learned a lot about affordable housing, I guess, during this process, but what that involves, permanent supportive housing, is housing that involves not only just a shelter for somebody, but also all kinds of programs like alcohol treatment, job training, child care, treatment of mental illness, and so on. Those expenditures on those types of things have nothing to do with increasing affordable housing stock, yet the measure would allow, in theory, 100% of that money to go to those types of programs. And finally, this is an issue that actually I realized after reading the measure a few times. The measure defines what constitutes affordable housing in the and puts that in the Constitution. The phrase affordable housing is not actually used in the measure, and I think it's exactly the same situation as the inflationary index provision. The measure seems to be about affordable housing, but in terms of the measure, affordable housing is actually defined sort of as an economic term, not as a physical structure type term, which is actually falls under affordable housing stock. Affordable housing is more about the person who's living in it, and it has to do with their income. Affordable housing stock has to do with the type of structures. The phrase affordable housing is actually not used in the measure anywhere. So I think that's a separate subject. It actually puts in a constitutional mandate as to what that term means and defines it in terms of how much income a person can earn to be deemed qualifying for affordable housing. I can turn now to some of the provisions that I think are unconstitutionally ambiguous, unless you have any questions about those issues.
Well, maybe we ought to just go ahead and take that group and find out if there's questions or any discussion about that. I guess there were several things that I maybe wanted to ask about or comment upon for purposes of fleshing out the discussion, at least in my mind a little bit, and maybe working backwards. I don't know. I think the point I'm assuming is accurate and well taken, that if a term is defined and it's not used, something that potentially could be a problem. I do see in the purpose and finding section a reference to affordable housing opportunities, and I don't know whether that is a rationale for using the defining affordable housing or not. I just now noticed that, but I wonder if that phrase affordable housing opportunities is consistent with the definition of affordable housing.
Well, I think that's actually, that's a question I think more for the proponents of the measure, but you're right. I guess that is a reference there, but I think that's in the purpose section. It's not actually a term of art used anywhere in the measure. And as I said, there's a substantial difference, I think, between what affordable housing is and what affordable housing stock is.
True. Well, and I guess another thing on that one is, to my mind, this may be a bit of an academic exercise. If a measure defines a term that's not used, how fatal is that? And at least in this case, it's defining the very term that the measure is about, even if it doesn't use it. So it's even sort of twice as hard for me to find a single subject violation because of that fault with the drafting. But that's just my
opinion. I think this is subtle, but I think the measure is not about affordable housing. It's about affordable housing stock. It's about, at the start of the original hearing on this measure, the question was asked, what's the subject of the measure? And I think the description was it was to increase affordable housing stock. You can't increase affordable housing because affordable housing is, in terms of this measure, is defined as housing for people who whose 30% of their income would meet the expenditure requirements to define that term. So a given house on one day might be affordable housing for one person, but not on another day. So it's a very different term, even though we're sort of using the phrase affordable housing loosely in different contexts. It actually puts a provision in the Constitution that may have broader implications beyond this measure, much like the inflationary adjustment has no relation to the provision itself.
Okay.
Well, let me stay on that topic. I think you're right. What the measure is about largely is affordable housing stock, which, and I agree that trying to tie the definition of affordable housing to affordable housing stock isn't perfectly laid out in the measure, but wouldn't common sense reading of those two definitions suggest when you're trying to figure out in the definition of affordable housing stock what it means when it says affordable rental or affordable ownership using units, that to figure out what that means, you look to the definition of affordable housing, and then you say, oh, well, when we're dealing with affordable housing stock, we need to be looking for housing units that don't cost more than 30% of gross household income. I mean, isn't that a straightforward reading of
Well, two things. I think that's an important distinction, because in the definition of affordable housing stock, it uses a different term. It refers to affordable ownership units. That's an undefined term in the measure. So what's an affordable ownership unit versus, I mean, why didn't they use the phrase affordable housing if they meant affordable housing right there? They just defined it a paragraph above.
Right, exactly. And so if I'm trying to answer that question, it seems pretty straightforward that the way to answer it is to look at the definition of affordable housing unit and apply that basic concept, even though it's, I agree, it's not as perfectly laid out as it could be, but that doesn't, I'm not quite sure where that amounts to a something that means we can't set a title, which is the issue we've got in front of us now.
Well, I think you have, an undefined term, affordable ownership unit. I think we have to presume, and I think this board's role is to presume that the words have meaning and they were used for specific purposes. The phrase affordable housing unit meant affordable housing, then the proponent should have said affordable housing, but they, but the measure doesn't say that.
But they didn't, and so given what they did say, are we supposed to say, well, this is pretty obviously what you're trying to say and what a, the reasonable interpretation would be, rather than the interpretation that you came up with after reading it four or five times, that we should just apply sort of a reasonable interpretation? Because it seems to me if we do that and say, well, affordable housing is defined, affordable housing stock is units that meet this definition of affordable housing, even though in 2.2 they use affordable ownership units rather than affordable housing units or something like that. It seems to me that that's a pretty technical reason that's not required. It's not that confusing to me to do that, and it seems like a reasonable analysis. And I don't see any, I don't see what the potential unintended consequences of doing so would be. If it really was, well, we have no idea what affordable housing stock means, then maybe there'd be a problem. Or if it said, as used in anywhere in Colorado law, affordable housing means this, but it, that definition is tied purely to this article, and the logical place to apply it is in calculating what a, how much of the housing stock qualifies as affordable.
And the other important point about that, I think, is that nowhere in the measure does it require you make that calculation.
Well,
it says housing shall only be available to people who meet this definition. That definition is a, the phrase affordable housing is a sort of character trait of a person. It's not, it doesn't have anything to do with the house.
Well, not really. I mean, it's both, right? It's both the house and the person. It's how they relate to one another, right?
Except that, yeah, a house, a given house is not affordable housing for one person, but is for another person.
Right.
You could have $1 million house that might be affordable housing for one person.
Like an attorney at Brownstein.
I'll move to strike that.
Now, I see what you're saying. I just think we can apply some sort of a reasonable interpretation to this. And if I really... Obviously, I wish it were more accurately tied together, but I don't see, I don't quite get to the point yet of finding that to be a single subject violation.
I think the other issue is that the measure talks about housing being provided to people who earn different levels of income in the measure, whether it's low income, very low income, or workforce household. That's how it defines who shall be eligible for the available stock of housing. So it says 50% shall of the housing shall be made available to those in the very low income category. So those are sort of the economic thresholds that define when someone is available. So it's sort of, I don't understand how in the measure then the 30% threshold ties back into everything if it's defining when someone is available for the housing, or at least which housing shall be given to which category of people, in terms of low-income household, very low-income, or workforce. In some ways, the definition of affordable housing seems to conflict with those provisions.
Would it make sense to have the proponents explain some of that before we move on, or not?
If you'd like, you know, if you want to go ahead and...
I'm happy to do that.
While we're on this point, maybe it's more economical to just go back and forth. So, Mr. Ramey, if you're elected on behalf of proponents, perhaps to maybe explain.
Well, I'm going to try. I have a couple comments, and I may ask one of the drafters, if it's okay, as well, and speak about the drafting. As the board is aware, I'm standing in for Ms. Beach today, who is perhaps having a baby as we speak. I don't know. At least she's not here to do that. So. I think I will ask one of the drafters to stand up and answer that specific question. She was just explaining it to me in my ear. And she I think job explaining it to you.
That would be
I
great.
Can translate. A couple comments that I would make, I guess, initially. Let me a few things that I probably can comment directly on. Everything in this measure is intended to focus in the housing arena. There was some concern expressed by Mr. Dunn that somehow we were getting into either foreclosure issues or homelessness issues or perhaps other social issues, drug prevention, whatever the case may be, funding programs of that nature. That is not the intent or purpose, not intended to be the subject of the issue. For example, mitigating foreclosure itself, the point would be to make housing that otherwise might not be affordable, closed on, affordable at that moment in time. Providing temporary housing assistance and counseling and homeless is, again, a method of getting them into housing affordable in that context. In the context particularly of the permanent supportive housing issues, the focus would be on housing, funding housing and services related to housing, such as housing program directors on a temporary basis. It's not funding a drug rehab program. It's not a broader social issue and not intended to do that. The only other issue, and I hesitate even to raise it because there was some discussion, I was here last time and did hear it, about the loose-hanging phrase in the initiative, and the banks in particular was concerned about that. And I've certainly given some thought to that issue. That's the inflation adjustment phrase. Frankly, it doesn't belong there. It doesn't mean anything. It has no context, no purpose, no ability to be given any effect to it. Dunn did raise that phrase. And I would respectfully submit to the board that, again, this is, I hate to call it a typographical error, but it is literally that, a multi-word typographical error that, frankly, in operation could not be given any effect whatsoever in the measure. There's no way to do it. It doesn't mean anything. I regret that the phrase is there. It is there, but I would submit that if it could be given effect, there might be a single subject discussion to have based upon what that, the purpose of that effect might be. But in this particular case, it just can't. So I would respectfully submit the decision of the board last time on that issue was correct. Britta, can I ask you to respond to the more substantive question? She knows what she's talking about.
I'm Britta Fisher. I'm the chair of the Colorado Housing Investment Fund Coalition.
Thank you.
And affordable housing is a consistent theme throughout this whole measure, as was found in the title of this board. In fact, if you read in Section 3, Paragraph 2, it talks about use for grants and loans to support the statewide creation and preservation of affordable housing stock. Affordable housing and the services that are related to it, to getting people in housing and getting them into that stock, are part of the creation and preservation activities. So just as Mr. Ramey was saying, foreclosure, when somebody goes through a foreclosure, they're obviously in unaffordable housing, and the attempt is to get them into affordable housing for their household. So that would be a related activity. Also, we felt that the definition of affordable housing was important, not only because we put it in Section 1, but also because in several places throughout here, it says housing that is affordable, like in the definition of workforce household, we say affordable housing stock. It provides context for understanding what affordable housing is, since it is the consistent theme throughout the measure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, could you respond to Mr. Dunn's point that, I guess the point is kind of that what you're talking about here is not really affordable housing stock so much as helping low-income people with their housing issues. Isn't that really what's going on here?
If it's not related to creating or preserving affordable housing stock for that household, then it's not a related cost that can be covered by this fund.
So, I mean, so homelessness prevention,
what does that look like?
Yeah, what do you envision that entailing?
One of the best ways to prevent homelessness is to actually not allow people to become homeless. It's to provide temporary rental assistance. So when you provide temporary rental assistance, you're not necessarily funding a unit that's being built or developed. You're making it affordable for where they are at that moment. And so that's temporary housing assistance. And it's one of the best ways to prevent homelessness is to simply help them cover that rent or so forth so that they do not get evicted, and then to place them into a more affordable situation.
And then I think the other part of the question that I'm still trying to just make sure I'm okay on is the definition of affordable housing meant to define what's part of the definition number two, affordable rental or affordable ownership units?
Yes, because while we have restricted this fund's use to benefiting certain households, we also do not want to be putting people in a situation where they are paying more than what is generally understood to be affordable. And we felt that needed to be defined, what is generally understood to be affordable. And this is the HUD definition to give that.
I think that's all I've got on that. I don't know if we're moving on or what, but
well,
we have some
other
questions.
If I could say two things about that. I don't disagree that one way to help homeless, one way to help people avoid becoming homeless is to help them with their rent. That is not what the purpose of the measure is. The purpose of the measure is to increase the affordable housing stock, to increase how much housing is out there. It's a little bit like water. We just say housing. The measure is, can't say it's just about housing. Well, helping, I suppose, giving grants to teenage mothers arguably would help them terms of their housing, because they could use that money for housing. You could just about include any measure to say, well, ultimately, if it gives some sort of monetary benefit to somebody, it helps them avoid becoming homeless or it helps them stay in their housing. I don't think you can read the measure that broadly. The measure is intended to increase how much affordable housing stock is out there. And when you start saying, well, a drug treatment program helps someone avoid being homeless and it helps them with their housing, well, I suppose that's true. If someone's a drug addict and they can't go to work, they can't earn money, they can't afford a place to live. But I think that's too much of a stretch to say that drug treatment programs or HIV AIDS programs, and those are all definitions, those are concepts that I pulled from multiple sources off the internet, just sort of in what constitutes permanent housing solutions, for repeated themes throughout all those sites. Those are the type of programs that are involved in permanent housing solutions.
I may want to hear back from the proponents. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought they said something to the effect that was not intended to give money to people for things like drug.
I think they did say that, but that's not what the measure says.
Right. I'll grant you that the language may not be that tight, but certainly the statements from the proponents as to their intentions here, I think it's susceptible to that kind of reading, looking at the measure as a whole. Even though I would concede that the language is not, strictly speaking, if you look at each of those purposes, it's not strictly speaking limited just to housing-related purposes. That you could read it literally to give money to people.
Well, let's take it. I mean, if that seems to read, let's take it. It says affordable housing stock is defined to include permanent supportive housing. That is, at least from what I could discern, a housing context with not just to give someone a shelter, but programs related to getting them back on their feet, or those types of things. So even if you say, well, it might be a stretch to say that the measure would allow them to just write a check to somebody who has HIV and let them go on their way and say, well, that's related to housing because they might use it for housing. I think the measure can be read that way. But even if you think that's the reach, well, what if there is a housing shelter? This could argue, I think very arguably, in fact, I think it says, the money can be used to create multi-person housing units that have expensive programs involved, like job training, drug treatment, mental illness treatment. Those are more expensive than the housing itself, arguably. And I don't think you can argue that the measure not only doesn't allow that in its text, but that's not the intent of the measure. That's clearly the intent of the measure.
Well, I agree with you in one sense, that a lot of these things go beyond what we've got expressed, which is an effort to expand the availability of affordable housing. And in fact, I think you're right that basically by making some people more able to afford affordable housing, or that you're increasing demand for it, which in turn decreases the availability. But to me, the solution to that is to fix the statement of the single subject to more accurately capture everything that's going on here. And I think we can do that without having to go to something so broad that it doesn't work, like housing. I mean, a real estate transfer tax to expand affordable housing programs would seem to cover everything and would also seem to be narrow enough not to cause water-type single-subject problems.
Except that to take the example I just gave, if you provide a group shelter, the cost that goes into that shelter arguably is affordable housing. But everything else, which may make up 90% of the cost, all the programs have nothing to do with their housing. They've already got their housing. And all that extra, and this measure allows all that money to go into those programs.
Well, so what about to expand low-income housing programs? Those are related to, by definition, I think, the only reason that you think they're authorized here is because they have to do with homelessness prevention, right? And by definition, homelessness prevention programs are related to providing housing or to eliminating the need for public shelters, public housing. And so it seems to me that we can capture all this under that sort of slightly more general statement of the single subject.
Except that, let me give you a situation, and not to ask a question of the board, but tell me how this could be captured. Let's say I work at Isaacs and Rosenbaum and I make $1 million a year. And I, unfortunately, get into a foreclosure situation. And I then, under this measure, could take advantage of foreclosure programs available, foreclosure prevention programs. I could go use transfer tax dollars to educate me, to receive services, counseling, credit advice, all the things associated with foreclosure prevention, even though I make $1 million a year. I think that clearly fits within this measure, and yet has nothing to do with affordable housing.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that's true, given that the statement of how the fund is supposed to be created talks about providing housing for residents of the state from very low-income households, low-income households, workforce households.
Well, maybe $1 million is an exaggeration, but obviously a workforce household is defined as anybody who makes more than 120% of the mean income. It probably includes, depending on the income deviation, would be 60% or 70% of the public.
Government, lawyers, maybe. I mean, I see what you're saying, but it doesn't seem to me to be a single subject problem. Maybe we have to think a little bit about how to define it, but these are all, if they came in here with this measure and then in addition some effort to limit house sizes and create a new statewide zoning program and that sort of thing, and they said, hey, this is all about housing, then I would share your concern. But this all is pretty tightly related to dealing with people who are in danger of losing their homes or who can't afford or who have trouble affording typical housing. And to me, that's a single subject, and it's,
well, I would say problem if that were the case, then I would say funding of almost every social program in state government would fall under that. If it's just related to anybody who's not low income, because it defines people who are in 120% of the mean income. So basically, it's a funding mechanism for 60-70% of the public as it relates
to that. Well, fine. So say it didn't have any income issue and was just anybody who's anybody. Why would that not, why does that matter for single subject purposes?
Because I think you get to a point where the subject and the provisions of the measure are so attenuated, like water, that when you say housing and you say drug treatment programs and you say housing and you say teen pregnancy programs and you say housing and you say mental illness treatment, sure, I guess you could draw a connection or you could draw a line among the dots to get to housing, but the question is whether it serves the stated purpose of the measure, which is to increase affordable housing stock. The board can't change the purpose of the measure to broaden it to capture.
But the purpose of the measure isn't some thing that's set in stone. I mean we can discern the subject of it and the purpose of it. And I think you're right, it is a little bit broader than what was said before. But that doesn't mean that we're changing it. It just means we're recognizing that the purpose is broader than what we wrote down before.
Sure, except where the purpose becomes so broad, sort of collapses under its own weight. And I think that's what's happening here if you just say anything that happens to do with housing.
I agree. As I said, I just don't think this is quite that broad.
Well, let me turn maybe to, unless there's more discussion about any of that.
Okay.
To what I think are a few ambiguous provisions in the measure, which I think prohibit setting of a title and determining whether there is a single subject. Of course, the first one is the inflationary adjustment. There was a lengthy discussion last time. Ms. Eubanks objected and said that she found it to be a separate subject. And I think Mr. Hobbs and Mr. Domenico both said, well, it might not be a separate subject, but both of you, I think, communicated concerns about how it might be interpreted and what it means, how it impacts the measure. I agree with Mr. Ramey. He said it has nothing to do with the measure. And I think that in itself answers the question. If a substantive provision is in there and you can't say that requiring the General Assembly to do anything isn't substantive, then if it has no relation or nor connectedness to the measure, then it, by definition, is a separate subject.
Why? I agreed with everything in there except when you said, by definition, when you tell the General Assembly to do anything, it's substantive. I mean, the reason I voted for it is because it seems totally immaterial to me. And if something's totally immaterial, I don't see how it can be a separate subject.
But a separate subject is always, by definition, a separate subject is always immaterial to the primary subject of the measure.
Well, to the primary subject, right, but this is immaterial to anything.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think if you're a local government and you're trying to figure out what to use for an inflationary standard, or you're the state trying to figure out what to use for an inflationary standard, and there is now this provision on the books, arguably you're now required to follow this provision.
There are hundreds of places in the statutes where the telling agencies or whoever how to calculate inflation. Why would this be any different, even if the General Assembly actually followed through on this, which I doubt they would? Why would there be any reason that any local government would say this is the one we have to follow for whatever random purpose?
Well, I don't know if they would or not. They might. But the point is that it has nothing to do with affordable housing. The point is that it's not just whether the impact will be a little or a lot. The question is, it requires the General Assembly to do something that has nothing to do with this measure.
Well, but one thing that occurred to me in thinking about this since our last meeting is that I'm not sure that's technically true. There is a limiting phrase here that does limit it to this measure, and it's the introduction to that Section 5. I mean, what's in Section 5 is a list of things. It says the General Assembly shall enact in 2009 legislation as necessary to further the purpose of this article, including, and then there's a list. And I think this is the last item on the list, namely establishing a means for calculating annual inflation. But it's limited by the introduction that these are the things that the General Assembly is required to do as necessary to further the purposes of this article. And it seems like it confines it to nothing, because there is no purpose of this article to calculate an annual inflation. If this were open-ended, I could see how, yeah, they could go ahead and establish a means for calculating inflation, and then other programs could use it. It kind of reminds me of Mr. Domenico's point about the definition, that there's a limiting phrase there, too. It's as used in this article. If we were defining affordable housing for other purposes of state government, that would be more problematic, perhaps. But as long as everything is confined to this article, it seems like it's no harm, no foul, for lack of a better phrase.
And I think that's the point you raised last time. And you and Mr. Domenico both raised the question about, or to paraphrase Mr. Domenico, courts are reluctant to read constitutional language as a nullity. And I was concerned, well, maybe they'll inflation adjust the $40 or any of the other fiscal provisions in the measure. It's an ambiguity in the measure that makes it impossible then to determine. It's not only, I think it's a separate subject, but if it's not a separate subject, it's ambiguous enough, as you and Mr. Domenico both communicated last time, that you had concerns about how that would be interpreted, how that would be applied.
Well, and I am still concerned about it, partly because just even my own explanation of, well, it seems immaterial, is a little bit unsatisfying, because if someone came in here with some measure and then just for fun they put in a measure that's a line in there that didn't have anything to do with anything, that said, oh, and Section 5B3 said Jason Dunn is a terrific lawyer. That would
be constitutional.
Yes. That would be, in addition to being a falsehood, would be a, would be a immaterial to whatever else was going on. But I would think we'd have trouble approving something like that if it was in a just in some kind of substantive provision and then that was just put in there for fun. And so I'm still troubled by it. But on the other hand, I'm not sure our job is to say, oh, look, we caught you in leaving in. I don't think I can quite agree that it's a typo, although someone forgot to hit delete, I guess. But it is not quite – that's my example is not perfectly analogous, and so I'm just
– this kind of goes to the broader issue of the measure itself. I mean, you have – and the problems with the definition of affordable housing and affordable, affordable units, and affordable housing stock. You have the problem here about an extra provision. You have, you know, the issue of the conflicting effective dates. And I see the board trying to continually look past errors in the measure and say, well, we know what you really meant. And I think at some point you have to say, measure has to be taken as drafted. And the measure, the proponents have to be held to their text. If they meant something different, they should go back and write what they meant. But I don't think it's the role of the board to continually, even in one measure, let alone a separate measure, but continually fix language in the measure so that you wind up at the end of the day with a measure that says something different than what's on the paper. And I think, you know, the effective dates is a great example. Section 4 says, well, it's effective, the tax shall be effective after January 1. Section 6 says the effective date of Section 4 is July 1. When asked last time, well, which one do you want, the proponent said, well, we meant July 1, even though Section 4 itself says effective January 1, and that was what was put in the title. I don't know how you use either one of those in the title because they say two completely different things, and this is not, as I say in the motion, it's not academic. In fact, with your revised fiscal note, it's even less academic. It's more substantive because now you're talking about a six-month period with a difference of $25 million, whether you guys arbitrarily choose July 1 or January 1 based on whichever now the proponents say here they'd like imposed. That's a huge difference. That's a huge amount of money, and it's huge if you're the guy selling your house and have the tax imposed in February, March, or April, or May, or June. I don't think that's a typographical error you can look past. And I think it creates confusion for the local governments. When the local government says, okay, do we have to start collecting this transfer tax now in January, or do we collect it in July? Looking at their city attorney is going to look at the measure and say, well, it says January, but the title said July, and the title board seemed to want it to be July, but we don't know what to do. I mean, is there any doubt that will result in litigation, that someone will challenge that and say, you can't collect this fee on me until July, and someone else will say, well, no, it was supposed to be January?
That actually is, to me, the most troublesome of the sort of these issues. We kind of did basically just take the proponent's word for it last time. And I suspect that given that and given the way the title is written that incorporates that fairly clearly, the reason I voted in favor of it last time was that I suspect that if someone tried to impose the transfer tax on January 2nd, that they'd have a good that person paying the tax would have a very strong case that they don't actually have to pay it, given the ambiguity between the two dates that would be explained by all this background. But that is troublesome to me, and I've been trying to figure out how it fits into kind of our charge, and I think it really is that I'm not sure I understand the measure itself when the tax begins, and I'm not sure that we are allowed to say, well, I don't understand how this measure is going to work, but we can fix it by writing a title that clears it up, and therefore the measure combined with the way we've written the title is clear, and we'll just trust that the title will help define the measure. That, I think, is going beyond our authority. Because as it's written, I don't know. I agree. It's not clear to me when you would have to start paying the tax. It's just, it's not even an ambiguity. It says two different things on the exact same subject. I'm not sure any kind of canon of interpretation would help you answer it, would lead to a clear answer. They're both very specific statements. If anything, the one in section 4 is more specific because it only relates to one, and so I'm troubled by that, and much more than I am by anything else, although I'm a bit troubled still by the inflation thing. I don't know if anybody else shares that concern on the board.
Well, I agree. I'm more troubled by that than the other things we've talked about so far, which to me, I mean, I don't have the perfect characterization, but are more minor drafting issues than single subject issues or even title setting issues. But here there is a bit of a dilemma. I mean, there is an internal conflict in the measure. I guess where I am on it right now, to kind of cut to the chase, is that it's a legal interpretation we don't necessarily even have to make. Maybe we do. I mean, the question is it a feature that we have to address in the title? On the one hand, we know from the case law there's plenty of times where there are legal issues that we can identify that we don't have to resolve. I mean, we leave that for the post-enactment implementation of a measure. And so to the extent that there are issues about this measure, in general, they don't bother me unless they either go to the heart of the measure for purposes of understanding it well enough to determine that it's a single subject, being able to accurately and fairly describe a major feature of the proposal. And even then, I'm not entirely sure that it's not appropriate simply to duck it, in the sense that if we have to mention it as a significant feature, try to be vague on how the courts might ultimately decide that issue.
Right, and I think it's the problem I have is I don't think I understand the measure without us putting our own interpretation on it well enough to set any title. Now, I was trying to think, if there were no effective date anywhere in it, would we set a title? And I think we would. That wouldn't be a problem. And so then I'm thinking, well, why should it be a problem if there are two conflicting effective dates in it? And to me, it is a different type of problem. It's not the same thing as if there were no effective date. It's that the measure is just inherently unclear and confusing about when the tax will begin to be applied. And if I were looking to transfer some real estate and I was faced with this, as Mr. Dunn points out, it's not insignificant. And it's not the same thing as the legislature or the governor could make it effective, upon signing. So
I would add one thing to that. I think, Mr. Hobbs, sort of the rule you were speaking of is one that can invent such a thing as title board rules of construction, is one when there's an ambiguity. And when I was in your shoes, I know we didn't have to resolve every ambiguity in the measure, that could be left for the courts, as long as we could explain what the measure does and how it does it. That's different than where the measure is inherently irreconcilable. I think rules of construction for ambiguities don't apply to that situation. I think what Mr. Domenico is saying is correct, is you can't discern what the measure does and how it does it, because it's not an insignificant amount of money. I mean, it's $25 million to the state. It's a couple thousand if I'm a real estate owner. If I'm Mr. Bro selling this building, it's not insignificant. And I think if you can't advise the voters, the voters can't read it and figure out what it does and how it does it. We're just inviting litigation, and you can't clearly describe the measure.
Well, I just don't know. I mean, I think what you're saying is if we can identify, forgetting about an ambiguous situation, you're saying if the principle we should follow is if we can identify anywhere in a measure two clearly conflicting provisions, no matter how minor. Maybe I'm pushing a little too hard on that one, but even if they're not, at the heart of the measure, we have an obligation as a title board to resolve that, and I'm just not sure that that's. I'm not quite sure I believe that.
Well, I don't think you have to resolve the question today about how that rule would apply to an issue, no matter how minor.
Okay.
This isn't at the heart of the matter. It's a vein. And it's right there.
I think it probably is a thing. Normally, especially if we had a delayed effective date. I mean, I think typically, I hope this is fairly accurate, if a measure is effective upon proclamation of the governor, we don't bother to say that. That's normal. Or if it's effective January 1, we would not normally bother to say that. I think typically where it's something out of the norm, where there's a delayed effective date, we typically say that. And so if we knew this was July 1, as we thought it might be, we might say that, July 1, 2009. But on the other hand, if we really don't know, I'm not sure that's fatal for the measure. It may be that we don't say, that we leave that to the courts, let the people vote on the measure. Maybe it's part of the arguments for or against it that people don't know how this is going to affect their property. But we should not necessarily, I don't know that we should take on legal issues that we don't have to face.
Well, just... the problem I have is the opposite of what you suggested. My problem is not that we have to resolve it, but that we can't. We shouldn't resolve it. It's not our, not only is it not our duty, it's outside our authority to resolve it. And so I think you identified our only other option to doing this, which I don't think we can do, is to not mention the effective date at all. In which case, the question to me becomes, are we then leaving out a material aspect of the measure? And so that's where I think you get into the point that you were just discussing. If it were, no matter how small, then I would say no. But the question is this a material aspect? And to me, it is, I think. And because it's material, that is, I mean, if it's half of the money, 6 months, that's a lot of money. The material issue to me when this starts, and if it's impossible to know from the measure when it starts. And it's not just that it's impossible to know and that someone would later have to put an effective date on it. It's that it says two different things. And so it will be some court picking between the two rather than some kind of thing that everybody, the normal way on proclamation of the governor. It's one or the other, and to me, I think it is material.
To me, it seems no less material than if it said one section, 4 cents per $100, or 5 cents per $100 in a different section. You might say, well, 1 cent isn't significant, and a court can pick one. The bottom line is you wouldn't know what the measure does and how it does it. And when you change the effective date, you change when the measure applies to, I'm guessing, thousands of real estate transactions. And if you can't say when it applies to those transactions, you guys know the case law says if you can't understand the measure, you can't set the title.
Let me ask a question that relates to that. I think, I mean, if we were talking about the amount of a tax, the rate of a tax, permanently, and we didn't know whether it was 4% or 5% or something like that. That may be a worst case. This is only a 6-month period we're worrying about. It's important. It's a lot of money. But it's only a temporary issue that a court could resolve. It's kind of where I am on this. But I guess here's my question. To the extent that we have to say in the title the tax increase for the first full fiscal year, does it affect that? Then I wouldn't know what to put in that if it did. But I'm not sure that it does affect that.
You know, OSPB, I don't think in their memo, I'd have to look at it again, said when they're assuming it starts. But I think that's a great question. Fiscal year obviously being October, September 30, would be a very different number in the first year.
I mean, that probably would turn me the other way around here. If we can't comply with Tabor because of this issue, then maybe I'd feel differently. On the other hand, if it doesn't affect that, I still think it's an issue that we need not say in the titles, that we leave it to the courts.
I agree with that. I think Mr. Domenico's right. You can't say it in the title because you don't know which one to pick. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only reason you picked the one you did is because you had a proponent who saw the conflict and needed to pick one, and you went with that. But there was no substantive decision for that. There was no, this one seems to be what they meant. As Mr. Domenico said, Section 4, if anything, is the more specific, and that has a January 1 date.
I think I tend to agree with you, I think, in that if this were an ambiguity, the statements of the proponents might be more influential on us and maybe the courts. But here, there's a matter of construction. If this were enacted in this form, I'm guessing it's less significant what the proponents said they meant. Rather, it's be more of a statutory construction issue, I'm guessing. And for us to make that decision based on the proponents' statements of intent, I just don't know that that's as influential to me. And I agree that I don't think we ought to. To me, we just simply wouldn't say it. We wouldn't refer to the July 1 date. We would just say it imposes the tax.
I think I think it's important to keep those issues bifurcated, because whether you can pick a date for the title is different than what Mr. Mitnico said, in that it's not that it's ambiguous. It's just the opposite. It's very explicit. Mm-hmm. It just says two different things, as if it said 4 cents and 5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how long it would take 4 cents and 5 cents, that 1 cent difference, to add up to $25 million. That's 5 years, 10 years, I have no idea. But I think we're all in agreement that if it said 4 cents and 5 cents in a different section, that would be substantive. But why then does it matter that it takes 6 months to recognize that flaw versus 5 or 10 years at a penny?
Do you have any case law about inherently conflicting provisions within a measure?
I don't, not with me. Which I move on to, well, that's sort of the end of the single subject, I guess. Single subject and ambiguity sections of the motion.
Well, maybe just go on. I don't know. I'd say just go on, and then we'll hear from proponents.
The rest all relates to the title. Okay.
Let's go ahead if that's okay with the board.
Well,
or stop.
Seems to me we should, but if we're gonna. Why don't we have a vote on the jurisdiction, and maybe we can save everybody some time. But
then I guess I'd like to have the proponents see if they have anything to add on the question of single subject. And I think you're right, Mr. Domenico. We ought to go ahead and resolve that.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I think this is less a single subject issue than the issue that Mr. Dunn is raising. The first issue is a single subject issue, and that's an extraneous phrase floating around in there about population adjustment. But this one is more of a, whether you call it ambiguity or conflicting provisions. I don't know if I have a whole lot to add to the discussion that just took place, except the following. Clearly, again, and I regret that this exists, there is I don't mean to use this term to belittle things, but a typographical error in the measure. The legislative history, which is being created here, was created last time and this time, makes it, I think, very clear what the intent was, and that is, as reflected in the title, that July 1, 2009 is the trigger date, that the earlier date is in fact in error. On top of that, the effective date of the provision that refers to January 1 is indeed July 1. I think that would be the interpretive effect that a court would give to it. I would hope that a court would give effect to the statements regarding the intent of the proponents. Certainly, if the title is presented in this fashion, that becomes part of the legislative history and would hopefully be part of the court. And I would add that in Section 5, there's a provision that the General Assembly is directed to establish the means for the county's collection of the revenue, so they have the ability to weigh in on that issue as well. I think the board can, in good faith and with all logic, set a title. This doesn't eliminate the fact that there, again, is a typographical error that says something else in the provision, and it is there. And I don't know what more we can say other than to emphasize that it is the July 1 date that is intended. The case law that I've seen, and I, like Mr. Dunn, don't have the cases with me. I'm sure we may have an opportunity to brief them, and we'll have them coming out of our ears at that point. But if the board finds itself sufficiently flummoxed by the proposition that's being presented, that you just can't state a title. You can't formulate this provision in terms of a title, and there's simply no way to do it, then I would agree, Mr. Hobbs and Mr. Dunn, that you should not set a title. I don't think you have jurisdiction to do it under the circumstances. Here, I think you can. The information has been given to you with which to do it, as much as, and I hate to harken back, this is more of an ambiguity question, but I'll just harken back because of personal recollection to the debate that Mr. Domenico and I had many, many, many months ago on how to define preferential treatment. And I was certainly arguing that could mean all kinds of things, and how can this board possibly set a title? Mr. Domenico, and I hate to give him credit for being right, but for the sake of this argument, I will do so.
It can happen.
The board could make a presumption. Mr. Hobbs, I'm being a little unfair, I guess, at this point because I'm remembering the transcript, but Mr. Hobbs, you made a statement in that hearing. Well, I think we can make a presumption about what a term means and what the effect of this provision will be, and therefore we can set a title. I think we have the ability to do it. And again, I would not argue that you were not right at that moment with that comment. I think this is a somewhat similar situation. You have the information you need. The board has what it needs, given the statements of the proponents and I think the general rules of interpretation, that July 1 will be the date. And I think the board can and should state that, and I think the board can set a title. We're not throwing up our hands or attempting to create obfuscation, and I don't think the board needs to put itself into that situation. I think there is a problem here. It will need to be addressed, I'm sure, but I think it can be addressed and a title can be set. I don't know what else to do other than to emphasize that. I don't know what else we could give you at this point. I could relate to a situation where we've got a misstated statute, as we had last time on one of the severance initiatives. Amending a statute in that particular case that didn't exist, but assume it was one that existed. I don't know what more the proponents can do at a point like that other than tell you, no, what we mean is X. And certainly it says X and Y, but what we mean is X. And I think that legislative history and that information to you has some power. It should be worth something to the board. I don't know if the board has any follow-up questions on that, but I don't know how else to state it. I think you can set a title. I don't think it makes the problem, such as it is, go away, but I think the outcome of the problem is probably fairly predictable.
I guess in the interest of time, I want to just suggest we go ahead and resolve single subject. I think a motion, there could be a motion to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent that the board finds that there's a violation of single subject and refuse to set titles, and that would, I think, moot the other things. And then if there is no motion or if it's unsuccessful, then we move on to the other issues. I guess from my perspective, where I am right now is I think Mr. Dunn's raised a number of issues, good issues about interpretation and drafting and implementation and so forth. I don't see that in my mind that they rise to the level of a single subject violation, although I agree that we may need to revisit the expression of the single subject in the titles. But I'm not yet convinced that there's a violation of a single subject. Ms. Eubanks?
I would find myself to be in the same position I was before in terms of the first issue that Mr. Dunn raised on single subject grounds, and that's in regard to the mandate on the General Assembly to enact legislation dealing with calculating annual inflation. And I think it's interesting in the discussion today that some of the terms used are, you know, this is an extraneous statement, the fact that you have the beginning language that the General Assembly shall enact legislation as necessary to further the purpose of this article, including but not limited to. So the things that are listed out are things that the proponents felt the General Assembly had to enact to further the purpose of this article. I don't think it's discretionary on the part of the General Assembly in terms of a constitutional mandate that it's extraneous. It's extraneous to the rest of the measure, and that's what bothers me about the single subject. I don't think it has any relation to affordable housing or affordable housing stock or where we end up in terms of describing that purpose of the measure. The fact of the matter is it is a provision within the measure, and it's not related at all to any of the other provisions. Whether that's by omission, a mistake, I understand that, and it's unfortunate. But to me, I'm where I was before in terms of single subject. In terms of the other arguments that Mr. Dunn raised on single subject, I don't feel them that they're compelling to base a decision that we don't have jurisdiction on those grounds. And so on single subject, I would grant the motion for rehearing in regard to the first argument on single subject. Now, if you want me to go ahead and touch upon the effective date provision or not, I mean, it's not really single subject, but it's up to you, or would they say that for...
Well, to me, it is a single subject issue, because if to me, it's whether we can set a title, whether we understand the measure well enough to set the title, which all falls under the subject, I think, or at least the jurisdictional question of whether we can move on to setting a title.
And so on that issue, I think that we could set a title not knowing on which date the real estate transfer tax would begin to be imposed, and that for a couple of reasons. One is that I don't think, I mean, we know that the meaning of this measure is to impose a real estate transfer tax on transactions and, in general, what that money is supposed to be used for. I mean, we know the meaning of the initiative. The fact that whether it's imposed on one date or the other, I think that's more of a matter of interpretation left to the courts. There's lots of other measures that we have set titles for before that are vague in terms of how they would be applied, but we know the meaning of what the measure is intended to do, and I think based on the case law, you know, the case law talks about if we don't understand the measure well enough to state a single subject in the title, then we shouldn't be setting the title. I think this is a different situation. It does go to one of the details, whether it would be more appropriate, as Mr. Hobbs suggested, perhaps to take out the reference to any date if we proceed with other, you know, with dealing with the title that we previously set. But I do think that on that ground we could go forward. I also believe that it doesn't cause us any Tabor problems in terms of coming out with the physical estimate, and that's because the language in Tabor talks about that the amount that's supposed to be included in the mandatory ballot language is the first full fiscal year dollar increase. So even if this tax were to be imposed starting January 1st, 2009, I believe that the information that we have on the revised fiscal note is for the first full fiscal year, which would be commencing July 1st, 2009. So I think the number that we have and that we would utilize complies with what Tabor requires. We don't have to worry about what the amount would be if it's imposed January 1st, 2009. And so that's where I am on that issue.
Well, I've moved closer to Ms. Eubanks on the question, as I said before, I think, on the question of the statement about calculating inflation since last time. And I do think it's a jurisdictional problem if we have a measure that's not just vague or ambiguous, in which case we can apply kind of our own analysis to it, but is truly inherently internally contradictory. And we are being asked to basically fix that contradiction. And that seems to me to be a real jurisdictional problem, something we can't do. Given that, Mr. Ramey's arguments, I think, are helpful, except, and obviously I'm tempted to agree with him. The problem is all his arguments would apply equally if we were using Mr. Dunn's analysis that in one place it said a tax rate of 4 cents and in another place it said 5 cents. In that, well, that we could all take it as a statement that what they meant was 4 cents and the 5 cents was just a typo, and we could put it in the title and that would help clarify it, and we could all hope that the courts would understand that. But it seems to me that would obviously be beyond our authority to fix that kind of a problem. And so then the only question to me is what's the difference here? And the only difference is a materiality question. And I do think it's material when the tax starts, especially considering how quickly after the election this could go into effect before the litigation that would, I guess, be required to clarify that would be over. And so that's problematical to me, that we could be, you know, a person could read this and say, well, it says July 1st, and it could end up getting nailed for lots of a big tax bill, and it seems to me to be a material term. And I think that's a jurisdictional question. And so given that I think Ms. Eubanks and I are both on the same page for different reasons, that we don't have jurisdiction to set a title, I would move that we grant the motion for rehearing for lack of jurisdiction and move on.
I'll second that.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-1. And then I think that moots out the other issues. So the title setting would be denied. Okay. That completes action on 86, and the time is 2:17 p.m.
So I'm out of here, right?
Oh, yeah.
Guys.
Okay. Bye.
Sure, thank you.
Looks like it's been a while.
Let's see, that's mine.
No, thanks. I can't believe I voted for Jason after he cut me off in traffic yesterday.
I don't know if I'm going to have that kind of conversation with Jason today, but...
Oh, yeah.
Dude, you ruined my paperclip.
I have more than enough, trust me.
All right.
Okay, I remember, 20 seconds, we're done.
Yeah, not like that first one?
Okay, let's move on to the next agenda item, which is 2007-2008, number 92, Employer Responsibility for Health Insurance. Mr. Bello, I think this you're representing proponents, I believe. If we'll start with you, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record. If you have anything you need to tell us, let us know, and otherwise we'll ask some questions maybe.
Yes, Michael Bello, representing the proponents of this measure. And I don't have any specific issues about the single subject. I think this is clearly a single subject, the subject of it being to require private sector employers with 20 or more employees to provide major medical health care coverage. And the mechanisms that they either provide it directly by offering it through a carrier, insurance carrier, or they can provide it indirectly by paying a premium to the health insurance authority, which would be set up by this measure. So we think that is clearly a single subject, that there are implementation details that relate to that single subject, which have to do with the health care authority and how it should be funded. How it shouldn't be funded also, that is by general funds from the general appropriations from the General Assembly. But we do believe that it is clearly a single subject and that all the details are necessary details for implementation of the measure. I do have some questions should we get to or when we get to the wording of the ballot title, but I'll leave those for now.
Okay. Are there any questions concerning the measure for the proponents? Ms. Eubanks?
If you could help me a little bit, because I'm not very up to speed on insurance, but in terms of the insurance that would be provided indirectly through the authority, is it my correct understanding that the employers pay the premiums to the authority? I mean, in terms of the situation where the measure directly deals with the amount of premiums that employees would pay when the insurance is provided directly by the employers. I'm just wondering, sort of the flip side, when the insurance is provided through the authority, is the employer completely responsible for paying the premiums to the authority, or does the employee have some responsibility for cost?
The premiums that the employer who does not provide coverage directly would pay to the insurance authority would be in an amount necessary to have coverage that meets the requirement that 20%, no more than 20% of the employees be paid, or no more than 20% of the premium be paid by the employee if he's covered directly. So they would not pay a greater premium to the insurance authority, then they would pay their proportion of the premium for coverage directly to the employee. So other than the way this is envisioned would be that since part of the funding of the insurance authority would be paid by the premiums paid by the employers who do not provide coverage directly, that there might be some additional surcharge or fee or something of that nature that the employers might have to pay in a premium for the funding portion of the health insurance authority. But it's not envisioned here that proposed here, that the employers would pay a higher premium, like 100% of coverage, for example, than they would pay if they were providing it directly other than the surcharge for paying for the costs of funding the insurance authority.
So in the scenario where the benefits are provided indirectly through the authority, is part of the amount that's remitted by the employer actually costs that are paid by the employee, similar to when it's paid, you know, provided directly and they're paying part of the premium?
That's one of those details which we think would be left to the General Assembly. I certainly could envision that the employer would just have to pay so much of a premium as it would have to pay to have a complying direct policy, that is 80% for a direct policy. So they would pay so much of the premium to the authority as would be necessary to effect that type of coverage.
Okay, but so
but it could be, I think it could be determined by the General Assembly or the Health Insurance Authority.
But at this point, the measure doesn't directly address that particular issue for the indirect provision.
Correct.
And so the provision dealing with the sort of the cap on how much employees can be paid of the premium cost is only applicable to when the employer provides the insurance directly?
Well, I think that not strictly speaking, because it does say that the at the last subsection 4, the last sentence, in the alternative, employer shall provide health care coverage indirectly by paying premiums to the authority in such amounts as are determined by the authority to fulfill the requirements of this section. The requirements of this section include the 20%, 30% ratios, so that it is envisioned that, and that's the expectation, that they would not pay 100% of the employee's coverage for a premium paid directly to the or indirectly to the authority. It would be built in that they would have the same type of requirements of 80-20 or 70-30. That would be reflected in the premium they would pay to the insurance authority.
And so the employee caps would be applicable,
yes,
under both scenarios?
It would be.
Okay, thank you.
That's what we intend.
Any other questions for Mr. Billow?
I'd like to follow up on that cap question. Trying to understand what happens if an employee decides that he or she wants to buy more comprehensive care than offered by the employer, and assuming, of course, that the General Assembly, that the basic plan offered by the employer is what the General Assembly says they have to provide. They provide a more comprehensive plan. They offer a more comprehensive plan. One, the premiums are $100, and the employee pays $20 of it. The other is a premium of $200, and the employee be required to pay $120 of it?
This is a threshold, and so long as the policy complies with the major medical coverage, keeping in mind that that would be a term that would be defined by the General Assembly, and let's say that consisted of hospitalization and co-pays for doctor's visits and some of the things we typically think of, I think, as major medical coverage. Let's say there was something like dental coverage, which
is
optional.
Or fertilization treatment.
Or vision, or something
vision.
Like that.
I mean,
those would be not affected by this measure. And that would, if the employee had to pay an extra 100% of that in order to get that, that would not be affected. This sets a floor, a minimum employer health insurance coverage responsibility. And so long as they comply with that responsibility, if there are additional coverages that are not considered to be major medical coverage by the General Assembly and the Health Insurance Authority, then it would be subject to a negotiation, essentially, between the employer and the employee, or some. It would not be the same 70-30 or 80-20 requirements would not apply to that component.
I have different subjects, so I just want to make sure we're done on this one.
Does that clarify?
Yeah, it does. Okay. Moving on to the...
Yes, go ahead.
On Section 6, you talk about that the General Assembly shall provide for the administration of the authority. Does that, in your mind, also include the actual structure of the authority? Because it doesn't talk about who it is, what it is. Is there a commissioner? Is there a board? You don't provide any of that information here.
Right.
And I'm not sure I would use the term administration to define all that, but I'm a little concerned about that term.
Well, that is the intent of the proponents is that for the General Assembly, in its wisdom, to determine the structure, the exact nature of the authority. There's a, I'm trying to think of the other healthcare statute that's where they have set up a kind of an authority. It's I may have it here. But it is our intent that it would be the General Assembly's decision to set up the structure of the authority, whether it would be a departmental level agency, whether it would be some sort of quasi-private agency, and it would be for the General Assembly to determine the most effective mechanism and structure for the Health Insurance Authority.
Any other questions? Then let's turn then to the question of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement. Any discussion? Is there anybody who wishes to testify on that issue? If not, then I'll turn to board discussion on the single subject issue. Ms. Eubanks?
I think that number 92 comprises a single subject, and I would move that the board find so and move forward and set a title for it.
I'll second that. Any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff prepared drafts. Ms. Gomez has displayed them on the screen in the room. Mr. Bellow, I think you said you did have some issues with the staff draft.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hobson. Specifically, we have questions about two of the clauses, starting with, I'll make sure mine lines up with yours. It doesn't.
And mine doesn't either, so I don't know.
I'll be pretty.
So if we want, I don't know, whichever's convenient for you.
Just to describe the phrase.
All right, it's bottom of the very last word of line 8 on the screen, starting with opting to provide health care. We disagree with the use of the word prohibiting there. The statute or the measure as drafted does not use the word prohibiting. What we say is that to comply with, to have a complying policy, the employer shall not require the employee to pay more than 20% of the premium for employee-only coverage or 30% of the premium for dependent coverage. And so I'm concerned about the word prohibiting. It's not used in the statute. I think it's a word that has a lot stronger connotations than the words which I think would be appropriate, and our proposal would be that should say providing that to comply with this section, employers opting to provide health care coverage directly shall not require employees to pay more than 20%.
So how is that not prohibiting?
Because the employer would have the if they didn't provide a plan that complied with the requirements, the 20%, 80% ratio, for example, then I think the way this would probably work, and again, some of the details would be spelled out by the General Assembly, would be that would not be a complying policy, but it wouldn't prohibit them from offering that policy. They might have to pay some premium to the additional premium to the insurance authority. If let's say that they had a policy that was 60% employee pay, 40% employer pay, there might be some additional premium that they would be required pay, or else they would have to, if that didn't comply, the other way of resolving that would be the insurance authority could reject that policy. That's not a complying policy. Therefore, you have to contribute. You have to make premium contributions. That's not prohibiting.
I just have a hard time believing that your client or some other client, when the rules would be issued by the authority, wouldn't take those rules to court and say you didn't comply with this because you're allowing them to
offer a plan that requires a higher premium from the employee. I can't imagine that the lawsuit coming out of this wouldn't be, no, you have to, the employer has to provide 80% of the premium for the employee, and the rules of the authority are counter to the amendment.
What I'm suggesting, Mr. Blue, would be, using just as an example, a clerical example, the employer requires the employee to pay 80% of the cost, and the employer pays 20% of the cost. Call it a Walmart plan. And that would not be a complying plan. So I would expect that the insurance authority would say that plan is not in compliance, so you have to pay premiums to the insurance authority for a complying plan. I don't think that's prohibiting. I guess what I'm differing with is that that's not prohibiting the employer from offering that plan. That's saying that that plan would not comply, and that they would have an alternative, which would be to pay premiums to the authority.
So if the authority passed rules that said that, what you've just described, are you telling me that you wouldn't bring a lawsuit that says that those are invalid rules under the amendment? I mean, because it seems to me that that's prohibited by the amendment for the authority to promulgate rules that allow for premiums for employers higher than 20%, for employees higher than 20%, based on additional premiums paid into the authority. There's nowhere in this language of the amendment that allows such a construct by the authority, and I can't imagine that your client or another person, and I don't want to pick on you, but you're the proponent, so I would expect it would be your client, would file a lawsuit and say that doesn't comply with the amendment. And so, you know, I mean, I'm a little concerned that we're talking at this from two sides today because we want to keep the word prohibit out of it, and then tomorrow when the authority takes that advice from you, to come around and say, hey, it does prohibit it.
All right. Well, I go back to a couple points. And first, we don't use the word prohibit in the drafting of the measure. But second, and I think maybe I'm not making myself clear here, I certainly would not envision that the authority could say, if you have this, let's say, 80% paid by the employee and 20% paid by the employer, you know, it flips the reverse of what this measure would require. I certainly would not envision that the authority would say that's a complying policy. No, I definitely that would be prohibited. But what I'm saying is that the authority would say that policy doesn't comply. Therefore, you, employer, have to pay premiums to the insurance authority in order to have a complying policy. So I think that's.
But they wouldn't be paying premiums to the authority because the premiums are paid to the insurance company. So they wouldn't be paying premiums to the authority. They would essentially be paying fines. Right.
This measure doesn't provide for fines. This measure provides for the authority to levy premiums for employers that don't have complying policies. So if it was not a complying policy, the way this would work would be the authority would say that's not a complying policy. Either you get a complying policy or you pay premiums for a complying policy through the authority.
Then the authority would provide that policy
by contracting with carriers itself, using sort of market strength in order to contract with carriers to provide such coverage. I hope I'm not missing words.
I think using the word prohibit actually is a very succinct way of saying what the amendment does. And I see why the staff used it, and I don't have a problem with it. I'm trying to get to a point to, you know, I'd rather agree with you than not agree with you on this, but I'm not sure I'm there, and that's.
And I think I'm not either, but I want to see if I'm missing something. I mean, I think this clause is about employers who opt to provide coverage directly, and again, they're not paying premiums to the authority. I think they either have their own carrier or they're self-insured, I think. And we're saying in that instance where the employers are doing this directly, the measure prohibits, and I know the measure doesn't use that term, but it seems like this is accurate, the measure prohibits those employers from requiring their employees to pay more than 20% or 30%. I mean, I think I heard you say that Well, that's too strong a phrase, because the employer could go the indirect route and pay premiums to the authority, but that's not what this clause is about. This is limited just to the situation where they're not paying premiums to the authority. I don't know. Like I say, it just seems like it's accurate. And I don't mind if there were a way to avoid saying prohibiting. I wouldn't mind. But the one suggestion I think I heard sounded like it was a little cumbersome, because it used the word requiring twice, and to comply with this section, which doesn't, in the text of the title, context of the title, is unclear. And
I it does sound a little bit more cumbersome. I'll say that, to comply with this measure, comma, and the employers opting to provide. And that's certainly the intent of the measure to state it in that manner. And it's not just because I'm afraid of the word prohibit, but
okay,
it is for a purpose here. But I understand Mr. Blue's concerns and your concerns. You believe that that's essentially the same thing. The problem, I would prefer to see the word requiring in there, because that's really the what it does. But then you'd use it twice.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Eubanks.
And this goes back to our earlier discussion about the cap and whether it really applies to just where insurance, healthcare coverage is provided directly by the employer or also indirectly through the authority. And I thought in our previous discussion that the cap actually applies to both those circumstances. And yet the language right now only talks about directly. Okay. And so I'm not sure that including the language about at least employers opting to provide healthcare coverage directly, I'm not sure that's an accurate description of the measure based on our earlier discussion, if I was understanding it correctly?
I think you're right.
I understand your point.
I misunderstood.
So that doesn't help us on how we start the phrase.
But we've just made it a little bit more difficult to deal with.
Well, it's maybe taking some language out. Whether we put other language in there, I don't know. But I just wanted to make that point, because I don't think that the phrase as it appears in the staff draft, based on our earlier discussion, is accurate.
True. I think that the way that would be best worded to cover both of those points, the point that an indirect coverage the employer would pay the same percent of premium, would be that providing that employers shall not
Ms. Eubanks.
If I could, and
yes.
I'm just throwing this out as one possibility. If we, understanding that for healthcare coverage that's complying with the measure, whether it's offered directly or provided indirectly through the authority, so if we say something, if we have the phrase beginning, for healthcare coverage offered or provided in compliance with this measure, comma, and then have the statement being employees, I don't know, we need a verb, I guess, but something, drop the whole employers, but basically talk about that employees shall not be required to pay more than 20% of the premium for health care coverage for themselves and no more than 30% of the coverage for the employee's dependents. We still need a verb, but...
See, and it's funny, because I actually was going a similar direction, but just adding that introductory language you use,
okay,
and then prohibiting employers from providing health care coverage directly or indirectly through the authority from requiring employees to pay. So that way we keep the same language and just expand it to be both directly and indirectly. So, and actually I don't know if I would even use the introductory language you use. You could just do it by saying prohibiting employers opting to provide health care coverage directly, comma, or indirectly through the authority, comma, from requiring employees to pay more than 20% or more than 30%. I think that's a very clean, succinct way to say it, and it covers both circumstances.
And perhaps we don't have to go into whether it's directly or indirectly, because...
We could even take that out.
Because since the previous phrase talks about how the coverage is provided either directly or indirectly, at that point then we just talk about health care coverage?
Opting to provide health care coverage and take out directly.
But if I
then
could...
From requiring employees.
Mr. Bellow,
yes.
Let me see.
I disagree with the use of the word prohibiting. I don't think it's really necessary here, because I think that it could be shorter, more succinct, and also avoid what I believe is a word with connotations that go beyond the drafting of the language, to say that providing that employees shall not be required to pay more than 20% of the premium for such coverage for themselves and more than 30% of such coverage for the employee's dependents. I mean, it's because that's the key. It's whether it's a direct coverage by the employer or it's an indirect coverage through the insurance authority, employees would not be required to pay more than 20% for their own coverage and 30% for dependent coverage. So I think it simplifies it, and it also, I think it accomplishes those purposes.
I that sounds okay to me.
Do we
want to
try something on the screen?
Yeah.
So I think you would strike, starting with prohibiting, all the way through requiring on the next line. And then I'll just take a shot and we can tweak it as we go. I'd insert for health care coverage offered or provided in compliance with this measure, comma, offered or provided in compliance with this measure, comma, providing that, then on the other side of employees, insert shall not be required. And then down on the next line, on line what is now 11, because we've removed the, let's see, do we have, okay, we're fine, because we have an earlier reference for healthcare coverage, so when we say such coverage, first back. At just a starting point.
Good. Do we need the first, the introductory clause to that? I mean, could you just say that providing that employee should not be required to pay more than 20% of the premium for such coverage, et cetera? I mean, isn't the context that we're talking about the health care coverage offered under the measure?
Or provide, yeah. I think offered supposed to cover direct and provided is indirect, but maybe we can just drop that completely and just say.
Yeah, but if we're going to go that route, I think you just start with providing that employees.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know whether on the first such coverage we might want to insert health care coverage there, just because otherwise, unless you think it, I don't know.
Okay.
You know. But
I still think that the word prohibiting is a better descriptor of what we're doing. But if we're going to go this route, I think you're right. I think you take out the for health care coverage offered or provided in compliance with this measure. Take out all that. And then...
Say providing that?
Yeah, all the way to the providing that on the next line. Dan?
I would agree with Mr. Blue and Mr. Hobbs on that. It's probably implicit in...
Provided employers shall not be required to pay. I mean, again, I still think that using the word prohibited is the better term here. I think it is clearer about what's happening. Your words can be clearer to the average person, but...
I mean, there may be one minor advantage of not saying employers. That I was trying to think through, but I'll go ahead and mention it. If we do say prohibiting employers from doing something, I don't want anybody to interpret that to mean all employers. It's just the employers who are subject to this, the people with the employers with 20 or more employees, I think. So I was concerned about that construction as well, and this does duck that.
Well, it's still there with the word employees.
I think this also has the advantage of covering the indirect coverage issue that was raised, banks raised.
You still have the issue of what employees.
Yeah, I mean,
you don't lose that issue.
Yeah, and I, at least at the time, I was thinking that it's in the context of the requirements of this measure, but
right.
Granted, it could be any employees.
Yeah, but I don't think that matters because I think it's in the context of the. Mm-hmm. So if you focus on employers or employees, I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
Because we've already limited what employers and employees we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think it's fine.
Employed by employers that are 20, have 20 more employees.
But I'm okay with this. I mean, it's. Mr. Bellow, are you?
I would agree with that formulation of the other. Point that I wanted to raise was one of the provisions of the measure is that the authority shall be funded by the premiums paid to it by employers who do not provide health care coverage directly, and that's not referred to in the proposed title, which I think could conceivably a voter could look at phrase forbidding the General Assembly from appropriating monies from the general fund to finance the cost of administering the health insurance authority. A voter could look at that and look at the entire title and the submission clause and say, well, how is it going to be funded then? If it's not going to be funded by General Assembly or monies from the general fund. So I think it, even though it might make it a little bit longer here, it might be appropriate to insert something referring to the funding mechanism for the which. And I have a proposal for that, how that could be incorporated.
And actually, that kind of raises a question I should have asked before, and I'm sorry. How do you envision, have you done a study to identify how many employers are going to go through the authority? Because what happens if nobody does, or we don't have enough people going through the authority, and this authority then becomes underfunded, and now we may not be hitting general funds, but we need to hit the legislature all of a sudden has to either raise fees or do other things to increase funds to the authority?
No, we haven't done a study. I mean, it would be hard to anticipate how many employers would be going through the insurance authority as opposed to providing a complying policy. The fact that it covers 20 or more employees, of course, reduces the universe already to percentage of Colorado employers. I don't know what the exact percentage is of Colorado employers with 20 or more employees, but that, of course, our intention is to not affect the smaller employers, but we haven't done a study to determine how many employers might likely have coverage that would comply or would opt out. We don't know.
I just would imagine, I can envision a set of rules by which the authority operates that encourages employers to provide it on their own, and therefore decrease the premiums coming into the authority, thereby underfunding the authority.
And the statute does provide, the initiative does provide that in subsection 3, that the General Assembly shall not be precluded from using other sources of revenue if necessary.
And that's my point. I mean, it looks like if we're going to go into this other sources of funding, we need to address the fact that there could very well be increased fees or other types of funding sources so that the people know that they're going to be, that they may have to pay higher fees for things.
Well, the language that I had thought of stating there would be, starting with that phrase that says forbidding. Providing that the General Assembly will not appropriate monies from the general fund to finance authority, comma, shall be funded by premiums paid to coverage directly.
But I think that doesn't get to the whole thing. It doesn't get to the issue of what happens if they don't provide enough premiums. I mean, we're talking about the General Assembly is going to, it is in the Constitution, General Assembly is going to have to fund it somehow.
Or we could add a phrase or other sources from the appropriated by the General Assembly. I guess my point was I thought it would be appropriate to have some reference to how it would be funded in the submission and ballot title clauses to not make a voter looking at this think that how is this going to be funded if it doesn't come from. So in a way, I'm sort of on the same page with you that if it just says forbidding the General Assembly from appropriating monies from the general fund, people are going to be scratching their heads and wondering how this would be funded. So we would add something along the lines of what I suggested and maybe add a phrase or other sources appropriation from the General Assembly. And we're making it longer, but we're making it clearer.
I tend to agree. I think it's pretty significant that the authority is to be funded by the premiums paid to it. I mean, that's how the authority is funded is seems to me kind of a significant thing. I'd almost say you don't need to say the General Assembly is prohibited from appropriating monies. That's significant, but the more significant thing to me is that really the primary, if not the exclusive source of funding, is intended to be the premiums. I understand there may be a question, depending on how events transpire, about what happens if the premiums are insufficient. I'd prefer not to go there. I mean, I to me, it's kind of speculative. It's a legitimate question, but I don't know what we would say about that right off, given the text of the measure.
I think that the simplest and most direct way of addressing would be deleting that phrase that starts with forbidding and ends with authority and replacing it with providing that the authority or the health insurance authority shall be funded by premiums paid to it by employers who do not provide health care coverage directly.
I don't think we can end there. I think you have to say something to get to the fact that the General Assembly can use other sources of revenue if necessary. Because I don't know how many employers only have 20 employees, but I'm sure it's not a high number. Most of those probably are going to provide their coverage directly. I think this authority is going to be underfunded. I think that when the people vote on something, they should know that it may impact the General Assembly's revenue streams. So I don't know how we're going to say it, but I agree with you. I think that it needs to be clearer than what's up there.
I'll miss you, Banks.
If I could ask a question first, is it true that the cost, we're not talking just about the cost of administering the authority, but it's also the cost of providing the coverage, the health care coverage also?
Yes.
I mean, both of those things are being funded through premiums.
Right.
And such other revenue sources other than the state general fund. Is that correct? Okay. And so whether or not we could say change the phrase where the cursor is, something along the lines of whether it's financing the cost of administering the health insurance authority and health care coverage provided, I don't know, through it or through the authority by premiums collected and revenue sources other than the state general fund. I mean, it's discretionary. I mean, you don't have specific other revenue sources yet. I mean, that would be still up for the General Assembly to determine, but whether you could do it in a way to indicate that there are other revenue sources other than the premiums and do it in a way that's pretty shorthand, but also saying that those revenue sources don't include the general fund, because I do think that that's perhaps an important concept in folks knowing that it's not coming from the sort of the general
But I think it's important
to the state.
And this actually, Ms. Eubanks raises a question in my mind about how the authority is going to purchase insurance on behalf of these companies and how it's going to fund itself, because we're using the term premiums, and to me a premium means the amount you pay for a policy. So if the authority is going to fund itself based on premiums by the employers who do not provide directly, that means that the authority has to purchase insurance from insurance carriers, and on top of it put up added fee on top of that for those insurers to fund itself or get additional revenue streams from the General Assembly. Am I wrong in interpreting it that way?
I think the way it would work would be, let's say it costs the employer $400 a month for the coverage for a complying policy, and the insurance authority could contract, given its bargaining power, being that it's able to bargain on a volume basis, and it comes up with it, to buy the same coverage, it's $400. Just let's use that. Maybe it would be less, actually, because they would have bargaining power. There might be, on top of that, some sort of a surcharge for the cost of funding the operation and administration of the insurance authority. I don't anticipate that that would be a large amount. So it might be $420 or $425.
Okay, so we're on the same page about how that'll work.
Right.
Do you envision this as being as the authority being allowed to put a fee or a tax or whatever word you want to use on employers who buy direct plans to help fund the authority?
No, not direct. No, I'm talking about indirect.
I know. I just want to make sure that we're... Because that's how I interpret it.
If the employer directly provides insurance that complies with this, it doesn't have anything to do with the insurance authority.
They give no money to the authority. And therefore, then the way the authority is going to get its money is on the surcharge on top of the premiums and from the General Assembly.
Hopefully the surcharge would be sufficient.
Assuming enough companies do it in the insurance, and so the surcharge can be low enough so it doesn't discourage enough people.
I think in certain respects, Mr. Blue, or in a lot of respects, you're right. In this respect, that I think the idea is to create an incentive for the employers to provide it themselves directly through a carrier. Because if they have to pay, if they can get it for $400 through a carrier, and they have to pay $425 to the, they're going to hopefully opt for the carrier.
And that's exactly why I'm worried about this funding stream.
But we don't know.
If we do end up with a situation like that, all of a sudden we're taking money out of the General Assembly's revenues, obviously not the general fund, but other revenue streams, and requiring those monies to fund the authority. And I think I think we need to put that in this title so that it's clear to the voters what they're voting on, that the General Assembly may be forced to come up with additional revenue.
Mr. Banks?
Stab at it?
I was trying to talk long enough so that you would come up with something.
I think you're running interference for me. Okay. Where the cursor is to strike the language all the way, that entire line, through finance. And inserting financing. And then after health insurance authority, later on in that line, before the comma, insert, and health care coverage provided through the authority. With premiums. I don't know whether we want this detail or not, but I'll say it right now, and then we can always take it out. Paid by employers and, comma, if necessary, comma, such revenue sources other than the state general fund as determined by the state legislature.
Do we say the General Assembly or a state legislature? What do we normally do in these things?
Well, I just know from experience working for the General Assembly that most people don't know what the General Assembly is. They know the state legislature. I think it might be more meaningful to them.
Okay, that's fine. And I was just trying to figure out what we normally do in...
I don't know if
there is a normal.
Yeah.
That actually raises a question for the proponent. And the question is, can the authority pay the premiums with money from the state legislature, or do they have to pay the premiums with the premiums paid by the employers? Are they going to? Can they shift, in other words, the burden of these premiums to the general population of the state, or does it have to be provided by the employer? I read it as the latter. Okay, then we should take out "and health care coverage provided through the authority." The very begin after on line 14, after authority, the inserted part "and health care coverage provided through the authority," I think that should be removed.
Well, if we remove that, then we remove the premiums, because possibly, I mean, you have two costs. Because when, especially when you look at the permissive language in the last sentence of subsection 3, it talks about the General Assembly shall not be precluded from using other sources of revenue to pay the cost of administering the authority or providing health care coverage mandated by this section.
My error is,
I had interpreted
that. That was my error, Ms. Eubanks. I'm sorry. You're right. I mean, I have to correct myself. It is the intent of the proponents that they would have the flexibility of also providing for some of the health premiums through sources other than the general fund. So I correct myself on that. Sorry.
And then I want to step back, because this raises a single issue problem for me. The title of this is Providing Health Care Insurance Through Employers. The last sentence of paragraph 3 provides also for providing health care insurance from the state for the employers, that the state can actually fund this, and you can shift the burden of this insurance to the general to the state as a whole through other financing mechanisms other than the general fund. And I think we're running into a single subject issue at that point.
Well, the single subject that we've set is health care coverage for employees. I mean, I guess in my mind you have two different ways that the health care coverage is being provided to employees.
But this is being sold as health care and coverage being provided to employees by their employers, indirectly or directly, but by their employers. And this removes it from that.
Well, I don't know that that necessarily means it can't be subsidized, which may be what that allows. I don't know that it doesn't say that the employers pay the entire cost.
I guess my problem is that this is all buried deep in here. We read, not me, because I haven't done this very much, but you guys read these things a lot, and we missed this piece of it when we were going through this. Even the proponent forgot that an option here is for the state to subsidize this to some extent. And it seems to me that we're on a second subject, because it's providing the state to subsidize as well, and or it's unclear and kind of hidden within the text that this is opening it up to the state taking over health care provision.
Well, Mr. Blue, I think the primary purpose of this clearly is for employers to provide health care coverage, and they provide that coverage directly by having a complying policy. They provide that policy indirectly by paying premiums. It says the authority shall be funded by the premiums. This clause at the end of subsection 3, which is all it does is at most introduce the possibility that if necessary to fund the authority or to help to subsidize the cost of health care coverage, money could be paid from sources other than the general fund. But clearly the general purpose of this and the mechanism is to require employers to provide health care coverage directly or indirectly. That, at most, that is just a implementation, a detail of implementation of the possibility that it might be necessary or appropriate for the General Assembly to, in part, subsidize health care coverage is not a second purpose. It's part of the implementation of the overall purpose of providing health care coverage to employees, directly or indirectly. So I don't see how that introduces it's all kind of like the tail wagging the dog here. That is providing at most some discretion to the General Assembly to use other sources if necessary. That doesn't transform this into a state-financed health care and insurance program.
I think it allows for a state-financed health care system, because the term "if necessary" will be, by the courts, will be interpreted to be at the General Assembly's discretion of what it means. And you can have, you know, employers, all they have to do is have five or six employers come in and testify in a hearing and say, we can't afford health and care, health insurance to the extent required by this thing, by this amendment. Therefore, we need your help. And that opens it up to the General Assembly subsidizing this care when this is being billed as an employer-provided service, and all of a sudden it's shifted out. I have a problem with that. I mean, if this is going to be that, if that's what we're trying to do here, then we need to be explicit about what we're trying to do.
But it doesn't seem to me that that's what we're trying to do. I mean, I want to explore this a little bit more about what other sources of revenue could be used. I think there's some limitations there. But I mean, this whole subsection 3 prohibits the General Assembly from using the general fund, which would be right off the only source I can think of, as opposed to fees. That there might be legal problems with that. And in any event, the stronger principle is the authority shall be funded by premiums paid. This is only like a backup. It seems to me that a fair reading of this is only a backup provision in case, as Mr. Blue has suggested, there might be a shortfall that if necessary, then there might be other sources of revenue, although I don't know what they would be. So certainly not sufficient that I can think of to actually completely turn this upside down, you know, kind of contrary to what seems to be stated here, and make it something other than what it appears to be.
I know that the General Assembly this year passed a number of fees that have increased the revenues to the state significantly this year, and they can continue to do so. So there are other sources of funds that they could get to.
And one of the premises, excuse me for interrupting, but I mean, I'm stuck on the idea that fees are. Again, we get into this from time to time, the legal definition of a fee
versus
is that they're supposed to be an exchange of, you get something back from that. I can think of personally some examples that affect my agency that's not true, that our fees are used to support elections, for example. But in general, I think that's the legal concept, is that fees as opposed to taxes could not be used for the general purposes of government. And I'm not quite sure how the General Assembly could turn this upside down that way. I mean,
my concern is not that they could, is that they'll be forced to, because they're not going to be able to, because there's going to be employees who can't afford to pay 80% with whatever mandates they get, and from the General Assembly, and then all of a sudden the General Assembly has to step in to provide that coverage. That's where my concern is. And if this said instead that this could only provide, the General Assembly shall not be precluded from using other sources of revenue to pay for the cost of administering the authority, period, I wouldn't have a problem. But I think that now that we're, because that would go with what the clear purpose of this is to get employers to pay this stuff. I mean, that's what the purpose is employers to pay it, not the government.
I guess let's
do it this way, because obviously we're at an impasse. I would move to reopen the question of whether this is a single subject. I'm assuming I'm not going to get a second on that, but that would be my motion.
And I just to explain, I wouldn't second it, because it seems to me that this discussion doesn't bear on whether the subject is health care coverage for employees. I mean, regardless of the outcome of this discussion, it still seems to me that the measure is about health care coverage for employees. Now, who funds it, there's maybe a difference of opinion about that. But I wouldn't have a single subject problem. To me, the issue is more about how do we fairly and accurately describe the measure.
and titles.
And could I assume that Mrs. Eubanks is not going to second my motion?
I agree with Mr.
Okay.
Hobbs. I think this is an issue of describing what the measure provides and not a single subject issue.
Okay. Then could I ask that my vote be reversed on the single subject to go 2-1 as opposed to 3-0? Please.
No objection. I'm okay with that. Then
that way we can move on and not get stuck on this and debate for hours about this.
3-0 vote is too late. I don't know. I don't remember doing that before, but I don't have any objection to that.
Okay.
It's the measure still before us.
Right, and so now we're on back to this, and I think it needs to read exactly how Mrs. Eubanks said. Ms. Eubanks?
I'll go with most any.
Said, because I think it does allow for other revenue sources to pay for the premiums.
And I guess my question is if the proponents are comfortable with that language?
I think we are comfortable with that language. I do know that I agree with you that most people in places because when I have to measure, I have to use General Assembly or legislative
then
council
then
staff
to
correct me on that.
Well, no, it seems like we should be consistent through the title. I had forgotten that it was earlier, so to say General Assembly there is fine.
Don't capitalize it.
Although another issue is whether or not we really need to have the direction, you know, the phrase talking about the General Assembly's directed to enact sort of implementing legislation, but I don't know if that's a major component, but if we got rid of that reference to the General Assembly, then maybe we could still say state legislature, but I'm happy to leave it to General Assembly. I would move the language as it's reflected on the screen there on lines 14 through 16.
I'll second that. I want to just make sure. I mean, there may be a difference of opinion then about it. Again, I'm not sure whether it's about, you know, the predicting the future of this program, but I think that's accurate. And Mr. Bellow, is that? I just want to make sure that this accurately captures the words of the measure. The financing is from the premiums. That's the first requirement. It is supposed to be from premiums, and if necessary, non-general fund sources. I mean, that accurately.
And the only thing maybe we should, and I'll just throw this out. Maybe we should say premiums paid by employers to the authority, so people don't get confused that it's premiums paid to insurance carriers.
Okay. That's a friendly
to the
amendment.
Sure.
You know,
friendly amendment.
I would move the language as it's been amended.
And I'll second. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. Were you an aye or no?
I was an aye.
Aye, okay. That's 3-0.
My no is on the previous issue.
Gotcha. Okay.
If it's going to read it like it is, it needs to say it.
Okay.
Okay.
Other changes to the staff draft, Ms. Eubanks?
I didn't know if Mr. Mello had any other suggested changes.
Just to make the same changes consistent with these in the submission clause.
Yes. Ms. Eubanks?
I have just a couple of other small issues. One, down on line 17, in the phrase setting the effective date of the act, usually we refer to the measure, the act, and so I would suggest changing act, striking that word, and inserting measure.
I have no objection to that.
And then I was also wondering whether it should say to be no later, setting the effective date of the measure to be no later.
Agree.
And November 1st, 2009.
Agree.
I would move that change.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Are those I'm just going to make one point, and I don't know whether this changes it, but keeping in mind that the way this measure is set up is that we're asking the legislature to take action and giving it a year to take action, that in making it effective in any event no later than November 1st, 2009. I wonder if it would be appropriate to move that phrase of directing the General Assembly to enact such laws as are necessary to implement the measure closer to that. I don't know if that really adds anything to it or not, because to the last phrase, setting the effective date of the act no later than November 1st, 2009. The way it reads is the effective date of this section shall be delayed until the General Assembly has an opportunity to enact appropriate legislation to implement the requirements of this section. The effective date, in any event, shall not be delayed beyond November 1st, 2009. So it's designed as an incentive to the legislature to act and give it a year to act.
Ms. Eubanks.
As I indicated before, I don't know that the phrase to me about, you know, directing the General Assembly to enact legislation is necessarily a major component, although I agree that there's a lot of details to be fleshed out in implementing this measure. And so in my initial reaction to the staff draft was perhaps even taking that phrase out, but if Mr. Mello would like that language to be retained and to move it down onto line 17, I'd be willing to do that so that it comes right before the last phrase about setting the effective date. So if you move the language on line 12, that phrase, down to line 17 after assembly comma. I would move that change.
Second.
Third.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That's three to zero.
It was three.
Three to zero.
Okay. I got it.
That's all right. Ms. Eubanks.
Just one other small change. Up on line 5, in the phrase about allowing an employer to choose to provide, I don't know about the choice really. Is that important? It just seems like we could say allowing an employer to provide such health care coverage either directly or indirectly. So to strike to choose.
Sounds good.
Okay, I would move that change.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes?
Nothing further from the proponents. Thank you.
Then I'll go ahead and move that the board adopt the staff draft as amended with the understanding that the same changes would be made to the ballot title and submission clause.
Second.
Any further discussion? If
can
not,
you read it? I don't know whether you want to read it in the record, but I'm looking at it clean.
Pretty long. I think I won't read it into the record, but Ms. Gomez has shown it on the screen how it would read with those changes, so we'll pause. Any further discussion?
Nothing from the proponents. Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 92, and the time is 3:21 p.m.
Longer.
We're running behind. We need to pick up the pace. Mr. Bello, you have one more. Perhaps if we can do one more a little faster.
Do we still have a brief recess?
If you prefer. I just didn't want to keep you here unnecessarily.
I need some water.
Okay. 5 minutes?
No, we need